welcome to Conversations with the Legal Academy, a podcast from the University of Arkansas School of Law. My name is Dorinda Sharp.
And I'm Colin Hesse. On this episode, Dorinda talks with Jill Linz, associate professor at the University of Arkansas School of Law. They discussed her latest research on tort law and recognition of reproductive losses. Linz joined the U of A faculty in January 2018.
We hope you enjoy the conversation. Professor Linz, first, welcome to the University of Arkansas.
Thank you.
Or maybe I should say welcome back. You've been here as a visiting professor.
Yes, yes.
I want to start out talking about your research and teaching. I know you teach tort law and products liability and remedies, but right now the focus is tort law's recognition of reproductive losses. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, that's what my research is on right now. It's a bit of a new interest for me, and it's a very personal interest for me, I will warn you, because it happened to me this past summer. Oh, goodness, how many months ago was that now? 8 months ago? My son was stillborn.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah. Thank you. It was 2 weeks before he was supposed to be born, and my placenta completely detached, which is just not supposed to happen. It's like one in 160 pregnancies, I think, and even then, there's only like at most 40% chance that the baby doesn't make it. But that's exactly what unfortunately happened to me and to my husband and Caleb. Yeah, Caleb was stillborn. He died. And I think, honestly, part of my therapy has been, how does this work for tort law? You know, mine was not a case of medical malpractice. Nothing could have caught how quickly my placenta detached. But it does happen because of MedMal quite a bit. And there's actually with some new research out last month. It's February now. Research was out last month that suggested about one-fourth of stillbirths could be prevented through better medical care, which the study did not use the word medical malpractice, but that's what that is.
Yeah, exactly.
And it actually happens way more frequently than you would think, too. The most recent national data is 2013, and 24,000 babies stillborn a year. And that was in the United States. And I would assume it's more than that 5 years later now, but we don't have the data.
So 24,000. Our campus is 27,000, to put that in perspective.
And some of those babies are, just like Caleb was, Caleb would have been fine had he not been in my belly. He, you know, he was fully developed. Everything would have been fine. So, I mean, stillbirth is, I'm sorry, I should have said it's after 20 weeks. Okay. So if you lose a baby before 20 weeks of pregnancy, that's miscarriage.
Okay.
After 20 weeks is stillbirth. That's the medical definitions.
Okay.
So the stillbirth could include, you know, a baby at 22 weeks who probably wouldn't have made it anyways outside of the womb. Mm-hmm. But it also includes babies like Caleb and even babies that are like post 40 weeks. Like if the baby doesn't come, you know, when it's supposed to and, you know, the mom's still at 41 weeks, like when's this baby going to come out? So it includes a lot of babies that could have made it. So yes, this is my new research. How do states treat this, especially if it's MedMal or it could be like a car accident too. Mm-hmm. And I found a lot of variety that I wasn't expecting. The majority of states, including Arkansas, allow a wrongful death claim. Right, so a wrongful death claim is what you'd normally have if your child or your spouse was tortiously killed. You can bring a wrongful death claim. You still have to prove the tort, like the negligence, like the driver was negligent or the doctor was negligent. And a majority of states, again, including Arkansas, do allow that for an unborn baby also.
Okay.
So, if Josh and I had if it was in Arkansas and if it was MedMal, we would have a claim for our damages based on Caleb's death.
Okay.
Texas is in the minority, and Texas is where Caleb was born.
Because you came here from Baylor.
I came here from Baylor, yes, and so I was still there this summer. Texas does not recognize a wrongful death claim if it's MedMal. So in Texas, the state of the law was I would have a MedMal claim, but only me, not my husband. My husband would have no claim at all because there's no wrongful death claim, so there's only a negligence claim, and the doctor only owes a duty to me, not to my husband. That's traditional tort law, doctor-patient relationship. The damages would have been limited in Texas also only to mental anguish as opposed to lost relationship damages, which are called loss of consortium.
Okay.
But my claim in Texas would have been only me, only my mental anguish, and also there's this neat little damage cap that would have capped all of my damages, because all of my damages are what's called non-economic. I have no lost wages, no medical expenses. I mean, nothing. I mean, something physically did happen to me, but not, you know, nothing.
Right. It didn't incur additional medical expenses.
Yeah. I still got that neat little bill from the hospital, just as if he had been born alive. Sensitivity training could be helpful for both insurance companies and those hospital bills. But all of my damages are non-economic. Okay. So, and the way it's set up in Texas, which is kind of surprising, given its, you know, pro-life reputation, if it's med mal, actually, there's no wrongful death claim.
And I'm going to stop you real quick, just for listener purposes, med mal, medical malpractice.
Yes. Sorry. Okay. Sorry about that.
That's all right.
A doctor not, you know, acting consistent with the accepted practice.
Okay.
So, you know, if it was maybe it was even in delivery, right? And something came up that normally a doctor would have done an emergency C-section, but for whatever reason this doctor didn't.
Okay.
That would, you know, be medical malpractice.
Okay.
So, my most recent research project, my most recent, you know, little project that's a little bit more personal than usual for me, right, details how states deal with this, how, especially if it's usually going to be med mal for stillbirth. And even in the states that do it right, that have a wrongful death claim, you know, and Arkansas is one of these, there's still issues to me. Sometimes that wrongful death claim is based on the baby being viable,
okay,
which is supposed to mean baby could survive on his own outside mm-hmm. the womb. And I don't really I understand why states would want to set a limit, mm-hmm. Set a line. You know, at this point, you could recover, but if the baby's so young, you could not. Or
right.
Viability is a strange place to me, though, to set that line.
Mm-hmm.
But a bigger problem, even with wrongful death claims, or excuse me, even in states that recognize wrongful death, I don't know how many cases I saw that referred to the baby as a fetus. So mm-hmm. this is parents seeking compensation for the wrongful death of their child.
Mm-hmm.
And the court opinions keep saying fetus.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the parents did not say fetus, right?
Right.
No parent after pregnancy loss says we lost the fetus.
Right.
And I understand that that's medically appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
I guess technically until birth, the baby is technically a fetus.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand that that's medically appropriate, but when you're talking about tort law and getting parents compensation for the injury that they incurred, it's a different number.
Yeah.
You know, it's a different amount of damages when the parents lost a fetus as opposed to when parents lost their baby.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that word choice matters.
It's the same, like you said, with pro-choice life arguments.
Another
same. I mean, it's a similar conversation.
Exactly,
like.
And I think the abortion debate is why courts say fetus, even though the context isn't the tort context. It doesn't make sense to say fetus,
mm-hmm.
but I think that's why courts do it, and that's a problem with this. You know, some states are hesitant to recognize that wrongful death claim because of pro-choice groups.
Mm-hmm.
And the pro-choice movement. There actually was a push, I don't know how many years ago, parents like myself pushed politically in state legislatures to get birth certificates. You don't get a birth certificate when your baby is stillborn. You get a death certificate, but you don't get a birth certificate.
Wow.
Which is a very jarring thing.
Yeah.
Like, and it also sort of actually sums up stillbirth, like, how can there be a death if there wasn't a life?
Yeah.
But that's exactly how we record it statistically. back to a lot of parents, and they were successful in a lot of states, a lot of parents pushed, no, we want some legal recognition. We want a birth certificate. And a lot of states, I know Texas does because I have one, recognizes that now and allows us a certificate but to push back into abortion. Some states held off. Because there is that slippery slope fear. Well, if we, you know, if we're recognizing that this baby was born even though it was already dead, I mean, how do I sum this up? There's the slippery slope fear that any recognition
mm-hmm.
of the unborn will inhibit, can be used against arguments against abortion. And I understand that. And a huge chunk of my recent article, though, deals with, no, these are consistent.
Yeah.
And this should be an area where both sides can agree.
Yeah.
Right? Pro-choice groups should be able to acknowledge, look, when the parents and the mother wanted that pregnancy and it was tortiously lost,
yeah,
that deserves compensation. And I don't, you know, I don't see why that runs conflicting with the woman who chose not.
Right.
But I know there's a lot of people that disagree with me.
Yeah.
Right? But it does seem like one area to me that shouldn't we be able to set politics aside on this?
That's for some interesting research.
Oh, I will never say anything. It's hard. I mean, I wouldn't be doing this if it weren't for Caleb, and obviously that's the saddest thing that will ever happen, hopefully.
Yeah.
But I do see some redemption in it. Mm-hmm. And if I can do something to help, you know, maybe we get the laws in place the right way so they're sending the correct incentive to doctors, mm-hmm, right? And not that any money is ever going to help parents, but still, you know, even personally, still, I could, and again, mine wasn't MedMel. I love my doctor. But you can still do something. I mean, if I got money from a jury, I would put that to stillbirth research, right?
Right.
I could still, no, it's never going to, I'm never going to be whole.
Right.
But to me, that's not a reason to not
right. And
try to compensate.
Yeah, and in our society, for better or worse, it's money that makes something valuable. And so to have a dollar amount attached to it makes that life of value.
Yeah, and not too long ago, courts were hesitant to award consortium damages at all because there was a fear that it sort of cheapened the relationship. Like, if you can really put a dollar amount on a parent-child relationship,
yeah.
But again, though, that's not a reason to not attempt to compensate parents.
Yeah.
I mean, Arkansas is going to have the same issues coming up very quickly with that constitutional amendment, proposed constitutional amendment for non-economic damages,
mm-hmm,
that I think in November we're all going to go vote on.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, what you said is exactly the language. If I was looking at the right thing on the internet this morning. It defined non-economic damages as, you know, as injuries that have no money value.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I mean, this is personal, but I would trade some lost wages and medical expenses in a second.
Right.
And mm-hmm. So, that's a hard definition for me.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens with that amendment.
Yeah. Something to watch. So we know what got you into this research.
Yeah.
What led you into academics as opposed to practicing law?
Well, I did. No, I do not have a good answer for you on this. I remember it was second year of law school, and I was trying to figure out whether I wanted to be on the board for law review. It seemed like a lot of work, so I didn't really know if I wanted to, and I was talking.
But you did.
I did. Yes. I was talking to us, and at that time in my head, I had some idea that, hey, I wonder how this law professor thing works,
mm-hmm,
because then I talked to a third year student who was on board, and he said, if you have any inclinations that you want to, you need to be on board for law review. And I said, okay, yeah. So I had some inclinations. Where they came from, I don't really know. I did want to practice first, though. I think there's value in practicing before, you know, teaching our lawyers,
right,
who are going to practice. So I did practice. I practiced at a mid-sized firm in St. Louis. It was Blackwell Sanders at the time, which has since merged and is now actually a huge firm in the Midwest, Hush Blackwell. It's even in Texas now. So I did practice. About 3 or 4 years in, though, my husband, who we dated in law school also, he said, hey, remember how you were also thinking about trying to teach, though? And so he kind of gave me the reminder that I was interested in teaching also. And then we had a little long-distance marriage, because I taught for a year at Louisville. I was a visiting assistant professor at Louisville and learned so much. That's the first time I taught torts. That was before I even thought I wanted to teach torts, but that's what I taught at Louisville, which thankfully it all worked out.
That's just what they needed.
And I felt equipped to do it. I just didn't think that's what I wanted to do. But any experience teaching, of course, I thought was going to be helpful. And then luckily for me, though, that's what I was supposed to do. So I had a year at Louisville, and in the middle of that year, got my gig at Baylor.
Okay.
So we moved to Texas, and were there for seven or eight years, and it was great. I was at the law school. My husband was an assistant athletic director in compliance. We had our two girls. We had Caleb, and then Arkansas came along at a good time for us.
Yeah. So he's working on campus now, too.
He is. He's teaching college athletics now. Oh. The class isn't called that. But he's in the College of Health and Educational Professions.
Education and Health Professions.
There you go. Thank you. Education and Health Professions. And he's in their sports and sports management and recreation sub-department. Bigger university is a mystery to me, right? We're just in the one building in the one law school.
Exactly.
But he ultimately is in the department that is called Recreation and Sports Management, and he's teaching grad classes. He'll teach an NCAA compliance class, just like what he actually did at Baylor, he will teach here. And he had a lot of great opportunities at Baylor, even though... originally when we first got there, right, is when football started to rise, and he worked with Robert Griffin with RG3, so he worked with him to get his agent. So Josh had a lot of great exposure.
So you've been in Fayetteville about a month?
Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, what are some of your impressions of the town, of the campus in general? Good or bad?
It's good. Fayetteville has always reminded me, actually, of Madison, Wisconsin, except in the South.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in Wisconsin. I went to Madison undergrad,
okay.
And Iowa for law school, but Madison for undergrad. And it's Madison is this beautiful college campus surrounded by lakes,
mm-hmm.
and Fayetteville is this beautiful college campus surrounded by mountains.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of this little neat little place in a state that, it's just unique in the state. Madison is unique to the rest of the state of Wisconsin. Fayetteville is unique to the rest of Arkansas. So there's that sort of personal connection. We just love being a part of a college town and a college campus. And we're excited about the schools for our daughters.
Good. That's always nice.
We are excited about the public schools for our daughters. Our oldest is in kindergarten. We have only good things to say. And we actually live over on Mount Sequoia.
Close to campus.
We are very close to campus, which is another great perk for us. We have woods in our backyard. We have deer that come up and eat every day in our backyard, essentially. So it's sort of picturesque.
Yeah.
One of my daughter's little fairy tales, right? You know, the deer don't actually eat out of our hands, but maybe someday.
Yeah, I bet they could be trained to.
They might be trained to.
So you said you met your husband in law school. What took you to law school? You got your undergrad in political science.
Yeah,
is that
it was
right?
poli sci. Again, I don't have a great. I just always was going to.
It was just the plan.
It was always
forever.
The plan. It was always the plan. Big law wasn't necessarily the plan after law school, but. I was just always going to, and Iowa at the time, and I believe still at the time, was a great public institution that was affordable,
mm-hmm.
which is something that is so great about our law school,
yes.
And cannot be overstated.
Yes.
And so that's something that attracted me to Iowa, and yeah.
Do you remember when you first thought you wanted to be a lawyer? Are there lawyers in your family?
No. I have a better story for why I joined academia than I have no idea. Right? Did I watch too much Law and Order as a kid? I don't know. I was always very into. I wasn't always. I mean, I was very into politics in college. I just was always going to go to law school, though.
Say there's an undergrad listening to this right now. considering law school, what advice might you give them about either what to do to prepare or what to do to decide?
What to do to decide? And I know this is sort of a, I don't know, you know, this might be something I could get some, I just think a JD has such value, mm-hmm. right? And I just, you know, we teach you how to think critically. I mean, I honestly think practicing law actually has such value. I see that in my husband. Neither my husband nor I have practiced law for a long time, but, mm-hmm. you know, then just in the workplace, and he was in a compliance workplace, but there's just a professionalism and sort of a calmness that he could bring mm-hmm. Because of how he was trained,
yeah.
Both in practice, both in law school and in practicing law. So I think the JD has value in so many fields. You know, thinking about going to law school, though, I mean, get ready. We're serious, and it's going to be a lot of work.
Yeah.
So, you know, make sure it's something you want to do. But I do think the JD can take you places that, you know, just the simple BA or BS these days can't.
Makes sense. So in the same vein with current students, if there's a current law student, whether they're here at the U of A or someplace else listening, what advice would you have for them in the midst of law school, in the throes?
I mean, there's going to be challenging times. You know, there's always room for improvement. Oh, this is it bad at me? I'm thinking, though, of that student that, you know, maybe just got those grades back, right? Or like a month ago now.
Right. And someone who's just finished their first semester and they've just gone, what am I doing?
Yeah, what am I doing? you know, you're great. You're great. You are more than your grades.
Yeah.
You are more than your grades. And stick with it and find what you like. I mean, for me, I complained about law review before, didn't I? But then the thing I loved about law, I loved writing my note, right? I loved writing my note. I loved seeing that thing published.
Right.
So, and law school also gives you the freedom to find those classes. Now, I am a big advocate of also taking the classes that you will need to know for the bar exam, mm-hmm. but you also have some freedom to find some classes from the areas that you care about a little bit more also.
Yeah. I found it interesting in doing these interviews how many people went into law school thinking they were going to do one thing, and then there was this one class that completely just turned them onto another subject that, you know, that was, to use a cliche, that was their passion that they didn't know was their passion.
And sometimes professors have a way of showing you that you didn't realize before, right? Making you care about a subject that you didn't realize you cared about. Yeah, stick with it. There's high times and there's low times. That's also life, though, by the way.
That's true.
So, and sad to say, if you think you're overworked in law school, you know, in life sometimes, too.
Yeah.
There's going to be some times that you're like, oh, crap, I have so much to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, the one difference is that hopefully you will be getting paid for it in life as opposed to law school where you're paying.
Right.
But that's, you know, life has its ups and downs, and law school's going to have its ups and downs. There's a bigger picture. I'll never forget my first year of law school. Oh, I don't know. It probably was in my first semester, and I was complaining to my father that I was so busy. And he's just like, you're the only one, huh? like, that wasn't the message I was looking for. I was looking for some comfort, but he was absolutely correct.
Yeah. Yeah, everyone's busy, everyone's stressed. Every once in a while you meet someone who isn't.
They're lying. They're lying, right? You remember those people. I remember people after the first day of the bar exam, like, that wasn't that bad. I'm like, you're lying. That was horrible,
yeah.
right? And don't try to psych me out. Right? But it takes a while for you to have that mature realization because your first instinct is, oh, crap, like, what did I miss?
Yeah.
But the reality is if you prepared like you're supposed to, and you'll know whether you did that, right?
Right.
If you prepared, that person is lying.
You know what? I think that's a good place for us to wrap up. I love that ending. We're all stressed out. If you say you're not, you're lying.
You're lying. You're lying. You're either outright lying or unfortunately
lying to yourself.
You're lying to yourself. Yeah. One of the two.
Professor Lins, thank you so much. We're so glad to have you aboard.
Well, thank you.
And I'm sure we'll be doing this again at some point.
All right. Thank you.
For more information on Conversations with the Legal Academy, show notes, and additional episodes, go to law.uark.edu/podcast. Or you can find us at kuaf.com under the local and podcast menu. You can also listen to episodes or subscribe through iTunes or with your favorite podcast app. If you enjoy the show, please give us a review on Apple Podcasts, which will help others find us. Music for Conversations with the Legal Academy was written and performed by Josh Woodward. To keep up with us between episodes, follow the University of Arkansas School of Law on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for UARK Law. That's UARKLAW. Thank you for listening.